Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello? Hello? We're almost there. All right. Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Well, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording in about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Wednesday night, here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedy to the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over here at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy Is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy Is in the Law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for that disclaimer. You know that they're important. I welcome everyone to our call tonight. I see that many people on last night's call with what we talked about with regards to the overview and then how an LLC dovetails perfectly in everyone's plan, actually. Mr. Slevin, I think you've got an open mic in the back. You have this call being on a speakerphone or something. I'm hearing feedback.
Okay.
Anyways. Yeah, no problem. Anyways, so last night we gave the 30,000 foot overview. Still there. Of the programs that we offer through Your Remedies in the Law, Americans Restoring America, and how the LLC perfectly dovetails that Mr. Slevin offers to the group, perfectly dovetail into the Golden Horseshoe, and how you can arrange your life, whether you are an employee, a low-level employee, or whether you are an entrepreneur busting out and trying to make something, you know, out of what your dream is, or maybe you're an executive of a company that you own and or that you have influence over. There's a arrangement of your affairs. You like that phrase. It's been used often for the last 10, 15 years here. There's an arrangement of your affairs that Mr. Slevin has assembled with his team that enables you to operate through this unique LLC, different from all other LLCs that you're aware of, this unique LLC, so that at the end of the day, it's not having a tax response or liability in the law associated with it. So without further ado, it is my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin. Go ahead, Gunny. Mr. Slevin, go ahead. Have you muted your phone? I'm looking at him here. I hope we don't have a problem with our system tonight. Hey, welcome to the call, Brian. Mr. Slevin, can you hear me? Mr. Slevin, unmute your phone, please. Give us a moment, ladies and gentlemen. He's working it through. Let me make sure that.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. In fact, that voice is the voice for the next Verizon commercial. Go ahead, buddy. I'm muting out.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Herr Slevin here. And we would like to talk to you about how the income tax doesn't affect you and who it really does affect. And some of the background in that so that you will understand what our product really does for mainstream America. First, a little history lesson. So what is known as the organic documents of this country is the Declaration of Independence, which was published July 4, 1776. Now, folks, I really suggest you go back and read that every so often because it is a masterful work of reason, where reason is an extraordinary process, in fact, ordained by God. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, "Come now, let us reason together," says the Lord. "Though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool." End quote. Now, these fantastic visual words show us a process of setting what is perceived to be wrong to the right or to the correct. After we declared our independence from England and the monarchy thereof, the sovereignty of that construct devolved upon each of we the people. From a case called Chisholm v. Georgia in 1793, just a few years after the Constitution was ratified, we see this. It says, quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence," that being the feudal countries of Europe, "and constantly remind us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such idea obtains here in America. At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of this country. But they are sovereigns without subjects, unless the African slaves among us may be called so," in parentheses. and have none to govern but themselves. Semicolon. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in this sovereignty. So from this quote, we can plainly see that each American, by virtue of the Declaration and our forefathers, is thus a sovereign, a truly free man. And I use man in the context of a member of mankind, having a womb or not. In other words, we own ourselves. I own me, you own you. Our bodies are entitled to us alone. Therefore, the production of these bodies must belong to its sovereign conscience, that little voice in the back of your head that keeps you straight. However, that freedom or liberty, if you will, also carries great responsibility. Whereas the value of entitlement empowers us to make contracts, those agreements can easily trade away our bodies and its production for mere promises if one is not careful. Now, one of these promises is of security. You know, you've heard that all the time. You know, the government, quote unquote, is going to keep you safe. Well, we must turn to Benjamin Franklin, who once wrote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." You don't deserve anything if you're willing to give up that kind of greatness in your own sovereignty for some clown who says, "Oh, yeah, I got a better idea." So, in essence, we must remember the words of an ancient warrior who said, "Choose wisely when offered a benefit in trade for our birthright." As a reference, take a moment to study Genesis 25:29-34, where Esau actually sold his birthright for a bowl of porridge. Sickening when you think about it. Now let's take a minute to address that parenthetical comment in the Chisholm about the African slave. As I said, this was 1793, and the SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, seemed to have left the Negroes out in the cold. So from the case called Dred V. Scott in 1852, it says at page 60, this is where one of the justices had brought forth the writings of Justinian, a sixth century Roman emperor. The above account of slavery and its modifications will be found in the strictest conformity with the Institutes of Justinian. Thus, in Book 1, Title 3, it is said, quote, "The first general division of persons in respect to their rights is into free men and slaves," end quote. The same title, Section 4, quote, "Slaves are born such or become so. They are born such of bondswomen, a woman with a bond upon her. They become so either by the law of nations or by capture or by civil law." And in Section 5, quote, "In the condition of slaves there is no diversity, but among free persons there are many. Thus, some are in GI, or freemen, and others libertini, or freed men." And in the fourth Digenius, it says, quote, a free man is one who is born of free by being born in matrimony of parents who are both free, or both freed, or of parents of one free and one freed. But one born of a free mother, although the father be a slave or unknown, is free. So we jump forward from that, from Dred V. Scott to the 13th Amendment, which was ratified December 6, 1865, just after the cessation of the War of Northern Aggression. It says in Section 1, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, or any place subject to their jurisdiction." So it's properly talking about the United States being a union of independent nations. And Section 2 says, "The Congress shall have power to enforce this article upon appropriate legislation." So, 13th Amendment, we see the outlawing of slavery. Therefore, according to Justinian, any member of mankind born in America was free because the bond that was on some of the mothers, mostly Negro, had been extinguished. And then the 14th Amendment came along, and it, using false pretenses, it created two kinds of citizenship. One, the lowercase United States, lowercase c, United States citizen, and what is now known as the American national. This was due to the certification of the birth record and the application for Social Security benefits. The status has changed from our original sovereign self by virtue of our lineage to the people during the revolutionary times upon which that sovereignty devolved, and what is now called the United States lowercase c citizen. And so in order to recoup that status, you want to talk to Mr. GW because he's got it locked down tight. All right. Now, the United States Constitution was approved and ratified in 1788. And on December 1791, the Bill of Rights was ratified. So that created the government, as we call them. And it gave them, the Constitution gave them a center in which to set, which is a 10-mile square piece of property, piece of dirt. So that became what we now know as Washington, D.C., which is part of Maryland and Virginia, I believe. And then in the District of Columbia Act of 1871, it was an act of Congress. And what it did was it repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown and established a new territorial government for the whole of District of Columbia. So Congress makes the laws, and the District of Columbia has a mayor over the whole situation. All right. So some people say that it also that incorporated the District of Columbia. And we find in 28 U.S.C. 3002 definitions, as used in this chapter 15, United States means a federal corporation. What that also did, that Organic Act, was take D.C. and make it a city-state, completely independent from all other nations or cities or anything like that. Excuse me. Now, this city-state is in the same class with what's called the City of London, which is a one-square-mile enclave in Greater London, UK, as well as Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the city of Rome, Italy. These three city-states comprise the military, financial, and ecumenical power centers of the earth. These people truly believe that they own everything and everybody, just like the African slaves of old. And they believe it so forcefully that they enforce it with merciless efficiency. And I'm sure that you've seen evidences of that over time. So just to give you a little evidence that Washington, or D.C. for short, is a city-state, right after that, they started, after that Organic Act, they started acquiring foreign properties. So in 1898, the Spanish-American War had broken out, and the use of Pearl Harbor grew to great importance. So D.C. acquired those islands and as a territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple, who had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 U.S. Marines. Also, as a result of the war, D.C. acquired properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba, which was set free, in hindsight, probably wasn't a good idea because they still suffer from the Castro Revolution in the 1950s. The Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946, but it's still a mess. And Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories of D.C. and therefore ruled by them. There are also, but there are some rather interesting agencies headquartered there. In Puerto Rico, there is the Internal Revenue Agency, or excuse me, the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS. Now, I have some friends that say IRS really stands for It's Really Satan, but I digress. Nonetheless, D.C. specifically became a city-state by adopting a constitution. Now, it looks very much like the Constitution for the United States approved in 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. And you will see this in a lot of different publications, you know, just in the talking heads always, you know, universally refer to it as of the United States. Now, to understand that difference, we offer this from Wikipedia. Two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an Old West preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially comes on before. It comes from before, which also means on account of. Therefore, the city-state of D.C. can be seen as away from or without the union known as the lowercase u, United States of America. Now, I've thrown a lot of machinations at you with these Supreme Court decisions and everything. So these machinations are done by lexicographers, or lexicos for short, otherwise known as legislative draftsmen. Now, both of these guys are, or these jobs are wordsmiths. And as we know from our military days, if it ain't written down, it didn't happen. So the lexicos were called out a little bit by the Supreme Court in a case called Merchant's Loan and Trust, the Simtanka, in 1921. At 28, it says, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has adopted in the definition quoted what is believed to be commonly understood meaning of the terms which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. There. So not only does the Supreme Court consider itself the law of the land or the interpreters of the law of the land, now they talk about they're clairvoyant, obviously, because they knew what was in the minds of the people. So this is just more word salad. And to understand how this is used in today's parlance when talking with government officials, we look at a thing called the Flesch Index. That's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. And it runs from 101 to 100. And it is the a way of gauging the understanding of English language. So as an example, we have the typical newspaper, which is written at 8.5. A first-year college student understands about 11, and a law school graduate comprehends at about 15. So that's some fairly low numbers. And when we look at the code, Internal Revenue Code, if you will, it is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. In other words, folks, there is no way in the world they want you to know what they're talking about. And so they have contorted the language. And learning how to read those contortions takes a while. So what we'll try to do tonight is lay it out a little bit so that it is as simple as we can make it using this thing. So go back to the Constitution. And in the Constitution, in order to remain legitimate, a taxing statute must have three particulars. They are the subject of the tax, the measure of said tax, and a statement of liability. Now, the statement of liability, obviously, is the most important to the people, because without it, we don't know what we owe, and we don't know why these clowns from the IRS are coming after us. So the the constitutional provisions, just in case you care, that set up that way are from Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, and it says, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within the Union, according to their respective numbers. Then we find Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, semicolon, but all duties imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Then in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, it says, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. This clause basically refers to a tax on property, such as a tax based on the value of land, as well as a capitation, which is a head tax. And finally, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5, no duty or tax shall be laid upon articles exported from the states. So that's the original Constitution. And it says here, okay, so basically you've got two types of taxes. They are direct and indirect. All right. The direct is there are three taxable categories. They are people, property, and activities. And I've asked a bunch of people saying, you know, can you think of anything else in the world besides people, property, and activities? And so far, nobody has. So the direct tax must be by apportionment, as the original Constitution says, and the indirect must be uniform throughout the several states. Now, it's probably easier to use, instead of indirect, to keep it mentally separated, we use excise rather than indirect. So, as I said, the three categories of taxables are people, property, and activities. Direct taxes are applied to people and property via census, enumeration, and valuation. Indirect taxes, which is are placed on activities. However, there must be some way devised to measure the activity. So this has come down to time as calculating the production of said activity or flat fee on something necessary for the process. So, and one demonstration of this would be to say, or to ask, is there an excise tax on whiskey? Well, whiskey is property. It is a physical thing that you can consume. So it can't be an excise tax if it's on physical property. However, if it can't be an excise tax, can't be on whiskey, then whiskey must be the measure of the tax. And that's what they've come down to, is the using the verbiage, it is on something, like on whiskey, but the subject of the tax is truly the distillation, which is a privilege. Of course, some people argue about that, but anyway. So the distillation is the actual subject of the tax. The whiskey is the measure of the tax. Or they also set it upon a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery. So either way, you get the evidence that the tax has been paid by those little stickers you see around the top of the whiskey bottles. So in 1909, along comes this thing called the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment of Congress states, 16th Amendment states, quote, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states, comma, and without regard to any census or enumeration, period, end quote. So when you diagram this sentence, and this is when you're dealing with the Constitution, you must use the clear meaning rule. They can't do the word salad thing, but they try in nonetheless. So they have a power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states. Well, there's only two types of taxes, direct and excise. And direct, which is on people and property, must be apportioned. So by them saying that this is without apportionment among the several states, then it can't be direct. And then it follows on and says, and without regard to any census or enumeration, which, as I read earlier in the body of the Constitution, that was one of the phrases used. So therefore, this power that Congress has is to lay and collect a tax, an excise tax on income, but income is the measure of the tax, not the subject of the tax. It is the measure. So that little word salad aside, because we must maintain these constitutional definitions of only two great classes of taxation, which are direct and excise. So in order to maintain that, and so let me change something here real quick. So to really understand that definition and being measured, we'll go to, first we jump to the main case that came out of the August 5th revenue law. So in July, they passed the 16th Amendment and sent it off to ratification. And then 3 weeks later, on August 5th, they passed it a revenue act, which laid an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. All right. So here again, the word salad, on income, but income is the measure. And then the, the actual subject of the tax in the 1909 law was carrying on business in the corporate capacity, which is a privilege because you have to jump through a bunch of hoops and fill out a bunch of forms and submit them to the various secretaries of state of the several states in order to get incorporated. But there's a lot of great things that were part of that. And so where we really see the measurement is in this case called Stratton, Stratton Independence v. Hobart, which was after Flint v. Stone Tracy, which I'll get to in a second. But anyway, from Stratton, and however the operation shall be described, this is at 415, quote, and however the operation shall be described, the transaction is indubitably business within the fair meaning of the Act of 1909, and gains derived from it are properly and strictly income from that business. For income may be defined as gain derived from capital, from labor, or from both combined. To continue, here we have a combined operation of capital and labor. As to the alleged inequity of the operation between mining corporations and others, it is, of course, true that revenues derived from the working of mines result to some extent in the exhaustion of the capital. But the same is true of the earnings of the human brain and hand when unaided by capital. Yet such earnings are commonly dealt with in legislation as income. So, it may be said of many manufacturing corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, especially of those that have to do with the production of patented articles. Among it may be foretold from the beginning that the manufacturer will be profitable only for a limited time, at the end of which the capital value of the plant must be subject to material depletion. The annual gains of such corporation are certainly to be taken as income for the purposes of measuring the amount of tax. And then we jump down to page 417, and it says the statement of liability, quote, and the return which was to be made under oath by the president and treasurer or other officials having like duties, indicating the clearest manner that it was to set forth data that with the property proper accounting which appears upon the books of the corporation. Jump back over here. So that reinforces what I just said, that the subject of the tax is doing business in the corporate capacity. The measure of the tax is income. So to regress a little bit, Congress is barred from taxing anything that sustains the right to life. as stated in the Declaration of Independence. And I believe that's Mayberry v. Madison. But anyway, the taxes on income, therefore, must be on some type of privilege. All right. And this was laid out very good in Flint v. Stone Tracy, which was the first big case after the 1909 Revenue Act, which we just referenced. Okay, from Flint at 151, quote, "The tax under consideration, as we have construed the statutes, may be described as an excise upon a particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages which arise from the corporate or quasi-corporate organization, or when applied to insurance companies for doing business of such companies." Just a follow-on for that. If you look at the definition of employment in 7701, I believe it's C, it says for the term employee, it says, and it gives about 109 word word salad, the term employee includes a full-time life insurance salesman. And we'll get a little more on that. But anyway, that's where this comes from, because of Flint v. Stone Tracy, when it talks about insurance companies doing business. So, and at 152, if business is not done in the manner described in the statute, no tax is payable. All right? And a little later on in Flint v. Stone Tracy, they say that a private firm, a private individual, and a private partnership is not subject to the income tax. Now, synonyms for not subject are not liable or immune, okay? All of that being said, we come forward and say to Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code of today, it says, quote, "A partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed by this chapter." That happens to be Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is titled Normal Taxes and Surtaxes. And it clearly states that some folks are not taxed, cannot be taxed. So I realize jumping back and forth over a century is a little bit tedious, but in order to get a situation report, then we have to do it like this. So the case Flint v. Stone Tracy said that, yep, this is a good excise tax upon a particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity. But private individuals, private partnerships, and private firms are not subject to it. They are immune. And so Section 701 simply says that a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. So we look down at 7701A, definitions, and we find the term partnership. And partnership in part says the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. All right? So unincorporated organization is for partnership. So we look at 701. It says a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. So what would be an unincorporated organization? Well, it just so happens that when you apply for a limited liability company, which they were first legislated in 1977, and they were a combination of partnerships and the corporations, which had been around for centuries, it's you apply for it to the Secretary of State by an Articles of Organization application. And when the Secretary of State deems it worthy, they hand you a certificate of organization. So 701 can then be read to say a limited liability company as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right? So now we have the historical background. Oh, by the way, in 1913, a lot of shenanigans happened. One of them was the 16th Amendment was proposed that had been ratified. I believe that was in February, which if you look at the books, The Law That Never Was, they showed categorically that it could not have been according to the state legislators' records, the several states. And then in October of 1913, we had the Revenue Act. And because of Flint v. Stone Tracy, they got to say, there is hereby a tax, they got to leave off excise, upon income of 1% or whatever. All right? So they got to leave off the word excise, so nobody knows what kind of tax it is unless you study the history. And they got to leave off with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. So that became the format allowed, and legislatures all this time have been putting the same thing. There's hereby a tax imposed upon income. You know, it's shorthand. And we know this for a fact because in 1935, the Social Security Act came forward, and it was done in 11 separate titles because FDR, to use a point, knew that these things were shenanigans, and he didn't want them all to fall if one fell. So the tax, what we now know as FICA, was written down in Title 8. And in Title 8, it says, there is hereby a tax upon income with reference to employment. And so that's really cool, but then they go over and in Title 11 of the Social Security Act, they redefine employee and thereby employment, as well as another term, which is includes and including. And so in the Social Security Act of 1935, Title 11, it says the term employee includes the officer of a corporation. Ties it right back to 1909 and reaffirms that we're now using a shorthand version of imposing income taxes. And then the very next line, it says, the terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the term defined, within the meaning of the term defined. So there's about three double negatives in that sentence. So if you take those out, it comes down to the terms include and including shall be deemed to encompass whatever is within the meaning of the term defined. All right. Here again, a lot of word salad, and we can go back and blame the lexicos. So by this dissertation, we understand that the LLC, the limited liability company of any of the several states, are immune from the income tax. In other words, all business done under them, all the buying, selling, handling, or holding of goods is income tax free, and it's income tax free worldwide. All right. So that's the explanation of why of what we do as a product. Okay. So our product is called a private firm from Flint v. Stone Tracy, and it's based on a limited liability company formed in New Mexico. Why do we use New Mexico? First of all, privacy. On the the Articles of Organization, which is the application to have a limited liability company produced, in New Mexico, it requires two parties. Both of those parties can be other LLCs. So, whereas like in Nevada, Delaware, and possibly Wyoming, when you incorporate and or organize a company, they require a list of people that are doing this. And those governments of those three states will protect that list. But in New Mexico, it does not exist. There is no list to find on the public record. That, my dear, is privacy to the utmost. If it doesn't exist, you can't find it, use it against somebody. So our company goes to the Secretary of State of New Mexico with two parties on the Articles of Organization application. One is our parent company, and the other is a registered agent, which is a sister company to us. Those are the two parties on the application, both of which are LLCs. So we've been doing this a long time, and a lot of them, and this has always worked. So we apply using this methodology, pay the fee, and submit the application. Secretary of State of New Mexico goes, yep, you're good, here you go. And so he hands us a certificate of organization, which, as I said before, is the birth certificate or bona fides that these two LLCs that are on the application are entitled to do business under the name of this new LLC. Now, for our example, we'll use XYZ LLC. All right. So once XYZ LLC is now has been birthed, if you will, then we bring that to our office, and one of our personnel who has never filed a 1040 and therefore never asserted themselves as being a taxpayer, and therefore the IRS has no jurisdiction over them, goes to the IRS website and gets XYZ LLC an EIN, which stands for Employer Identification Number, which is a form of tax identification number. And there are several forms. And so when that happens, in the application to get an EIN, it says, choose one reason that best describes why you are applying for the EIN. All right, there's five. I won't tell you anyone because they don't count. The one we always use is banking purposes, which it says underneath, select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly, and when the law says strictly, they mean only, is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. So do you hear anything about federal taxation in there? No, because LLCs are not subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, which is chapter one, period. All right? So our personnel who is outside the jurisdiction of the IRS gets an EIN for, in our example, XYZ LLC. Then we bring it back to the office, and because on the IRS paperwork, at that point, that individual is known as the sole member of XYZ LLC. Then they hold a members meeting, and the company produces a resolution, and in that resolution, they appoint or commission a third party as the manager for XYZ LLC, in our example. Now, when in 1977, when they merged in legislation and made the statutory LLC or limited liability company, they had to take good parts of the corporation and the partnership to make this up. So where corporations have multiple types of officers, such as president, secretary, CEO, and so forth, and partnerships have officers known as general partners or limited partners, the single officer in a limited liability company is a manager. Now, you can put as many words in front of it as you want, like chief executive or whatever, but that is it. Manager is the only officer of a limited liability company. However, that company can have as many managers as it desires. And these are voted on by the members using their percentages of membership. So that's why we say LLCs are very, very simple. You have members and you have managers, and the members can be managers and managers can be members, but neither has to be either one. So back to our example, the XYZ LLC holds a meeting, produces a resolution, and then the party named on the resolution is a manager. That manager then takes these three pieces of paper, the EIN, his commission as a manager, otherwise known as a letter of authority, and the certificate of organization, and goes down to a bank or a local institution of finance or whatever, and gets XYZ LLC a checking account, all right? On the checking account, that manager is the signer. The beneficial owner is listed as our company, a limited liability company. This has been challenged in a few places because of some state regulations and everything, so we have to deal around with several different banks. But nonetheless, that's the basis of it. What that does is we bring it back to our office, and we bring up a pay-as-you-go cell phone. We put all of this electronic banking, and we also include Square app, which is a point-of-sale app, and then Cash app, which is a transfer app, on this phone. Put money in the accounts, make sure it all works, pass it back and forth, tune up everything to this thing, make sure everything's good, and then we send it out to the client in a box. It's literally a business in a box. And they open it up, and at that point, because our transfer is private, the only places that the client is in any way connected with XYZ LLC, or for example, is in the paperwork, and they're safe, and our company's safe. And ours is pretty secure. What theirs is, that you have to ask them. Nonetheless, that client can then open up this LLC, open up this box, and using the phone, start doing business, receiving payments for products and services that XYZ LLC, in our example, may create. And that client's name is nowhere near it. And that, folks, is privacy and anonymity. And it's rock solid because all business done under the name of that LLC is income tax free worldwide. What are your questions?
Well, I'm going to start with the first question is, how long have you been doing this?
Roughly 20 years.
Okay. And have there ever been in that 20 years issues that required litigation?
No.
Most excellent. Thank you. First question comes from Michael in Las Vegas, followed by Jennifer Sue in New York. Go ahead, Michael.
Good evening. This is similar to Section 83A as for a wage earner, a person that just works for wages, because it says in 83A that you're an arm's length away and wages are not taxable. But they go through word salad for page after page after page through that thing. And
yes.
But your system is actually more anonymous than that, so it's I don't see how anyone can't understand this.
Yeah, see, 83 is it's the perfect example of lexicos art. It is a word salad beyond belief. And that's the reason, you know, if you really look at my initial explanation, there's two types of taxes. There's direct and indirect, otherwise best known as excise. So you've got direct and excise. There's three taxable categories: people, property, and activities. That's it. So when you write the taxing situation, you have the subject, the measure, and the statement of liability. There's nothing more simple than that. And if the government was a smidgen of honest, they would just go ahead and write it like that, and everybody would be happy. There would be no discernment of what is, you know, a definition of a wage earner or employee, which is actually a full-time life insurance salesman. It's just nothing but a bunch of lies, and that's what's so sickening about it. However, when they say that a limited liability company is not subject to the income tax, that's what it means. That means not subject to, that means immune, that means you don't have to keep receipts, you don't have to talk to anybody, you don't have employees, because that's the definition. You have workers, and the workers perform, or performance it may be another word, and then they get paid for that. So whatever that pay is, they have agreed to it via contract, And if they particularly have some kind of income tax liability, then that's their responsibility, because there nothing comes from the business done by the LLC. What else would you like to say?
Well, most people that listen to this, most people that listen to this are how would I put this? One molecule away from plastic. They're on estrogen. Okay? And they're living in fear. They live in absolute and total fear. I know iron workers,
and that
they got a letter and went right down and paid $3,000 the next day.
Yep.
Scared to death.
Yep.
That's not me.
Good.
That's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Next is Miss Jennifer. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. My question is can the LLC be the presiding elder for a corporation's soul? And while it is the presiding elder, do business, because you're not actually mixing taxable and non-taxable income in any way? That's my question.
Okay, so as I said, the original first post-16th Amendment tax upon income legislation was on doing business in the corporate capacity. Therefore, the mixing of a corporation and a limited liability company in any way, it would be cumbersome. All right. I am in no wise any type of expert in corporate souls. And so, Michael, you could direct her to the person that is. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. All right. Again, press anything else, Jennifer?
No, I guess.
Yeah, Bernie's the one that's going to have to answer that question for you.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, you're welcome. Thank you. Again, press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, for any questions. I see some people on this call that have reached out to me this past week discussing this. All right. Yeah, there we go. Brent, what's up?
Hey, good evening. I don't have a light here. I wrote down some stuff. There was a gentleman by the name of Chet West who was doing something similar and creating these LLCs, and he was saying that the LLCs weren't taxable or whatever. And I read a court case, superior or district, whatever court case. It was an appeals opinion, and they put him in jail for tax evasion for doing this. Any comments on that?
That is true, and the meat of that was that according to the federal judiciary, when any human signs a 1040 and sends it into the IRS, they are accepting liability for the income tax for life. That is neither moral, legal, nor constitutional. But they do it because they get paid a tremendous amount of money to do that. Look up the thing called a court registry investment system, or CRIS for short, and how that pays off the federal judiciary. It's basically a slush fund that's managed for profit by people like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and so on. So when because the federal judiciary has brought about this change in the law, showing that the law is their province. In other words, a jury can only hear what that judge wants them to hear, considering the law, the statutes, the codes, whichever. So when a person is charged with tax evasion, they are brought in to a court of people who are ignorant, for lack of a better term. And so the judge can feed them only what they want.
that defendant is not tried upon the law. They are, in fact, tried upon what everybody knows. And, of course, prosecutors say this verbatim. Everybody knows you got to pay taxes. And he didn't because he didn't want to, and that's tax evasion. And the people in the jury nod their heads because they are ignorant of the situation. All the stuff that I just put in about that comes from the statutes at large in the history of the income tax. Maybe less than 1% of Americans have ever heard that, much less know it. So when you're brought in and you're being tried on an opinion of what everybody knows, the probabilities of you being successful in defeating that go out the window. And I believe that's what happened to Mr. West.
Well, that's the way the courts work these days. So how would a person that followed this path deal with that?
Well, first of all, our company builds the anonymity and the privacy. And so once the crux of the income tax scheme is third-party reporting. So from the IRS's eyes, they are the first party. The quote-unquote taxpayer is the second party. And people handing money to the taxpayer are the third party. All right. They may be classed as employers or contractors or payors, P-A-Y-O-R-S. Is what's the word that they made up and they put in the Internal Revenue Code. So these payors do things like create W-2s, 1099s, 1098s, K-2s, and there's a couple other minor ones. All these forms are third-party reporting, and they say without any evidence that this taxpayer received income of X amount. They hand that to the IRS. The IRS takes it as gospel, and they expect a return from the taxpayer so that the tax burden can be best calculated. Okay? So then the working under an LLC created by our company, there is no third-party reporting involved. If there is, it's on the EIN that our company gets for these new LLCs. And this is what happens to a 1099, say, that has the limited liability company name on it and that EIN. They get the 1099, they look at it, and they go, oh, that's nice, and they drop it in the trash can because they have no place to settle it with, because Section 701 specifically says that an LLC is not subject to the income tax imposed in Chapter 1. So that's the way our product protects people. There is no third-party reporting. There is no IRS intervention. And they can't. They are literally barred from talking to the IRS. The IRS is barred from talking to the limited liability companies because there's no subjectivity. There's no jurisdiction. The limited liability companies are immune from the income tax. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so the limited liability company, it's a pass-through entity, basically. Is that correct?
Well, pass-through is something that the IRS has used to define it to make it sound like there is still a liability that has to be paid. There is no liability for business done under the organization of the limited liability company, period. That's what Section 701 says. Okay?
Okay.
Any other questions?
I don't know enough at this point to voice any others.
Great,
Brent. If I might encourage you to this call is recorded. In case you aren't recording it on your end, and go back and pull the precise parts that Mr. Slevin was talking about and look for yourself just to verify.
Yeah.
Yeah. I must apologize. I have this possibly annoying character trait. I really love to be right. And so everything I say is you know, I gave you the documentations and quotations of where it all comes from. And so there's more than enough information there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It just seems that all these people out there that, you know, have an LLC, have a small business, they form an LLC for liability purposes, and they're still paying taxes.
That's because they don't understand the genuine way that the New Mexico legislators wrote these things. And I'm pretty sure that somebody got paid a whole lot of money to do it this way, because normally politicians don't give away the farm as this legislation seems to have done.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Brent. Appreciate you. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to have a short call tonight. Press star 2. Let me go check Freedom's Radio while you're thinking about that. And give me a moment to refresh here. Okay, we're good there. And then Michael from Lost Wages comes back. Go ahead, Michael.
If people tune in to your program, why don't they understand that any letter the IRS sends is null and void on its face? They have no jurisdiction. They have no jurisdiction, and they have no authority. And their letters by the Supreme Court, as stated, or the GAO, has stated that they cannot use any of that information they have to go after anyone.
That's true.
They can play games in their court.
Yeah, but that's the point. With the federal judiciary, it doesn't matter that they have no jurisdiction or anything. They are convinced and convicted that if you sign a 1040 to begin with, you accept liability for the income tax for life. That's the bulwark against what they sow everything else. So these third party reportings and these opinions that come before them are then reinforced, and then they put people in prison, which scares everybody else, and they just continue to reinforce this terror cycle over and over and over again. And you know, you hear it on the mainstream news, you hear it, and I've been in multiple different venues promoting our company's products, and you know, that is like the first words out of half the people's mouths that we talk to is, yeah, well, I don't want to go to jail. The terror is instilled in Americans, and that is a shame.
But don't they understand that that is an adhesion contract
No.
that the federal
No,
government
No, they do not understand that. They do not understand that.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've had people want to get violent with me after telling them what I know. And a friend of mine, and if you were ever to see me in person, you would think the thought of getting violent with myself is probably the farthest from most people's minds. Nonetheless, the people, we the people, have been just terrorized, and it's reinforced, and that they've been lied to, and it's just, it's sickening, but it was done on purpose. As I said, the constitutional tax system has two types of taxes, two classes of great classifications, as SCOTUS says, direct and excise, and three possible taxing people, property, and activities. And any legislation has to name the subject, the measure, and the liable party. That's it. And if they just stick to that, everybody'd be happy. But they can't, because then everybody know what they didn't have to do, and they just go about life and be prosperous. Go ahead.
All comes back to fear.
Yep, absolutely.
Ruling through fear. It's most of these federal judges, or all the tax court judges, they get a percentage. Prosecutor gets a percentage. I'll guarantee you none of them claim that as excess on their income tax form. So, you know, start going after them on that. Yeah, go after them on that issue and see how many of them run for cover or who comes knocking on your door.
Right.
Well, maybe people will start to wise up. I don't know.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mike. Next, and I guess we'll be about last, unless anybody else comes up, is Ron from Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola. Okay. I get that one. With the LLC, having two partners or two members as CRTs, there is no taxes to be charged because the CRTs are non-taxable. So even if there is a 1099 that is not put in the trash, even if it does go through, the CRTs stand alone on their own, right?
That is true. And the best way we can look at this when you're talking about using a CRT as the members of the LLC, if you will, because the two parties on the New Mexico application are the organizer and the registered agent. And so we have both of those types of individuals in-house. And on the Secretary of State of New Mexico's paperwork, it will always show that the organizer, which is one LLC, would be viewed as the owner in perpetuity on the public record. And then the registered agent, which is a sister company to our organizer, stays as that registered agent also in perpetuity because it's an LLC and it can never die. So when in business generally, if you were to go into a bank and say, hey, I want an account for my trust, they don't know what that means. 99% of them, they don't know what that means. They don't understand trust. And so they tend to balk at it because anytime you're dealing with a bureaucracy, they have a policy manual. And if it's not explicitly in that policy manual, they don't understand it. It doesn't speak their language. Okay. So with an LLC, what we've come to, once we started dealing with Michael's organization, we refer to it as a commercial interface. Because anytime you walk into a business and you say, yeah, I've got a limited liability company, they all know what that means. And there's some huge ones out there. I believe Daimler Chrysler is now an LLC, and that's huge. So, and there's multiple other examples. Nonetheless, business people understand LLCs, so it speaks their language. So the LLC is the perfect commercial interface between banking and or other business types and the CRTs. So that's the way we've come to describe that. Does that situate you well?
Yes. That's the clarification I was seeking.
Great. Thanks.
Any other questions, Ron?
I had one. It went in one ear and right out the other. So
that train left the station.
There must not have been anything in between.
All righty. Thank you so much. If you think about it before we hang up on this call, just ask, just press star 2 again. All right. Next is Ron from Rochester. Go ahead, Ron.
Talking to me?
Yes, sir, I are.
All right. I'm not in Rochester, so I asked. I hate to have burden you with this, but what's the cost of this?
$7,500.
Cool. All right.
Now, there's something else we want to add to it. We want to add two charitable religious trusts that you are the trustee to. And the purpose for that is overkill. I love overkill. I think if you're going to go out rabbit hunting, don't take your .22, take your shotgun. I mean, just unless you want to eat the thing, then you might want to do a .357 then or something, or a .308. But I believe in overkill. So the two charitable religious trusts are non-taxpayers, and they each own 50% share of the LLC, as opposed to one person coming in. So we just ask you to consider that and the wisdom that you've learned from Bernie on the Saturday calls that you've attended to.
How long does this process take to complete?
We're running about 8 weeks is typical. We've had some changes in the tax code. If you want to call up the or look up the IRS website and look at a thing called a 1099-K, which is going to put people that are called the gig economy into a twixt, because it used to be $20,000 before reporting was necessary, and that figure is now down to $600.
Wow.
And it used to be at least 200 transactions, and now they report all transactions. And I've seen several places on the mainstream media and stuff where they're talking about this 1099-K having to resolve it. So this is one of what we've referred to earlier as third-party reporting. And so it would behoove everybody that is in the gig economy, for lack of a better term, to get a private firm from our company. And so that when that 1099-K hits, all the IRS does with it is goes, oh, that's nice, and throws it in the shredder.
Well, this is definitely on my to-do list. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Ron. All right. And Jennifer, take us home.
So if the CRTs are 50% owners of the LLC, can the corp sole be the trustees of the CRTs?
Well, they're not. Well, they should be anyways. But the two CRTs are also in place to move right into the two foreign grantor trust children from the parent foreign grantor trust out of Belize, who then sends the money to the private interest foundation in Panama that sends all of the money back up into your corporation sole if you want it there or leave it in Panama, whichever. But the point is that.
I'm not talking about the horseshoe. I'm talking about this LLC.
The short answer is yes. And what this is doing, and I can't think of the Supreme Court justice that talked about it, but this is arranging your affairs to your best benefit. Say again, please.
Judge Leonard Hand.
That's the man. Yep. So
right.
all of this arrangement, yes, it's all possible. To answer your question, that is possible, and it can be accomplished by Michael's organization, to use a broad brush.
Okay. So the CRTs are the 50% owners of the LLC, and the corp souls are just the trustees of the two trusts.
That would be one way of doing it. Yes.
Okay. All right. Just wondered.
And I want to have clarity here for everybody involved that this is designed by Mr. Slevin's group to be a standalone thing. In other words, just John or Jane Doe stepping forward and wanting to have this done, and it can be done that way. Again, I love overkill. If I'm going to walk into the valley, I want to have Overwatch on my right and Overwatch on my left. Vectoring
air
in
cover.
On the valley. Yeah.
And air cover.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm providing when I say we start with the two CRTs, each having 50% share, and then when the finances become available because you're profiting in what you're doing, then go ahead and slip into the golden horseshoe, and it all comes together hand in glove. Okay. Anything else, Ms. Jennifer?
No, that's all. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Brent, welcome back.
So this sounds ideal for entrepreneurial type people.
Absolutely.
But employees.
Let's say you're...
I'm sorry?
Employees.
Yeah, let's say you're working for General Electric. How can you convince General Electric that... they should change your employee status from an individual into an LLC.
Okay. So you cannot be an LLC. An LLC is a separate and distinct legal identity from its managers or members. Okay. And I beg your apologies for going over this terminology again and again, but in this venue, it matters greatly. Okay. So the situation that an employee employer find themselves in is a contract. It may be verbal, it may be written. But the when the employer hires an employee, there's a contract, and they ask certain things from the employee, such as a social security number and their birth date and so on and so forth. All right. So the contract then states, you know, we'll pay you, the employee, to do these things, and we'll pay you in cash, in benefits, in whatever, whatever. And we'll also take out the taxes and all this. Okay, so all of this costs money to the employer, all right? So there's this thing called the burden rate, not to go in, not to beat it to death, but that is the bottom line that the employer pays for the employee. It is typically 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary of the employee. So we'll use big number, nice round numbers here. So you've got an, you know, you're an employee-employer relationship with General Electric, and you go to your boss and go, "Hey, boss, you know, you've told me over and over that I do a really good job. So what I would like to do is propose a new contract. Instead of having an employer, which is General Electric, talk to the employee, as in our early example, the employer, General Electric, as a company, will make a contract with XYZ LLC. That contract will state that Joe, who's doing a great job for General Electric, will do the exact same job, same time, same place, same bat channel. And right now, GE is paying Joe's salary, which is cash, of $100,000. So we know, Mr. General Electric, that that's costing you $160,000. So with this new contract, which $160,000 is $11,000 a month, something like that. Anyway. So what we're going to do is we're going to build this new contract. You get the same person doing the same great job for in the same time frame, and you're going to write one check per month, which is $10,000, to XYZ LLC. Now, that's a total of $120,000 expense from your bottom line, Mr. GE, over 1 year, and no paperwork other than maybe the 1099. Now, the 1099 will have the EIN of XYZ LLC on it, and we've already explained what that happens to that. So then, you know, this is plain simple business. It comes down to cash, bottom line cash. So instead of paying out $160,000, the company only pays out $120,000, and their paperwork goes way down. That is the way you would sell this new contract. Will everybody do it? No. Everybody doesn't ever do everything. Okay? It is simple negotiation. It is contract negotiation. Our company has been successful at doing this with multiple people. And so we know it works, and we can assist. We have one of the things that we do when what we do is build an entirely new business model. And whatever you do today is your business model. And so once you get ours in hand, there's a period of integration, okay, between the two business models. So that integration is covered under what we call our hotline services, which is free for the first year and by subscription every year after that. We charge $500 in year two and so on for that subscription, but it is optional. However, if you allow the subscription to lapse and then call in and need some help doing something or negotiation, then we charge you $500 an hour, first hour up front. So that's how we cover those contract negotiations and stuff like that. And yes, that is a higher than was quoted in some of our earlier programs. I want to make that disclaimer. So does that explanation give you hope about being an employee?
Yeah, but is there a way to, there's a, you know, there's a union involved, and then there's union benefits, and then there's, you know, the company car, and there's all these other, you know, employee type arrangements that are part of that contract. And
Well, you have okay. Let's take it down to bottom line dollars, okay? By in the standard employee-employer relationship, you give 40% of your salary to the government. All right. So you have to make the decision. It's called a risk-to-reward matrix, in which does that 40%, if you were able to put it in your pocket, cover those quote-unquote benefits that are part of that present employer-employee relationship. And only you can make that decision. But we know that the process of becoming a quote-unquote contractor with the XYZ LLC interspaced in between you and the company is possible. It can be done, and it's all negotiation. And that's all business ever is negotiation. Does that make it better?
Yeah, I'm not very confident that my employer would agree to any of that, those negotiations.
Yeah.
So this would be something that I would, I guess, yeah, I'm not quite sure how that would fit in at this point.
Right, right. Yeah, this is probably very new information to you. And so, you know, with any new set of information, there's the first initial thing is like, what? And then it's, you know, you have to study it. But as I said, I have this annoying, possibly annoying character trait that I really love to be right. And so everything that I'm espousing is documented.
Have you been successful with large corporations and you know, highly paid, important employees switching over to this arrangement with large corporations like that?
When you say large corporations, you're talking about employees over 500 employees.
Yeah, more like 100,000 employees or more.
Well, the way the IRS differentiates between large companies and small companies is the 500 employee line. That's the demarcation that they've done. I can't say that we have been successful with large corporations. There are some gray areas in some of our clients' negotiations that I can't go into, but as a general rule, probably not. But, you know, there's no harm in trying because, as I said, when you reference the burden rate, you're talking about their bottom line. And I guarantee you that these companies would just love to be able to cut their bottom line by 30 or 40%.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all I have for tonight. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very, very much. It's time, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Please return Saturday with Justice Beshear when we will go over the corporation soul and the charitable religious trust and other things. And I believe he has some information regarding the event that he'll be sharing with you, hopefully, perfectly. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.